Obviously, America is the greatest nation in the entire world, but other countries actually have a lot going for them when it comes to history and cultural stuff, and we're going to get into it. So, welcome back to another T-Rex Talk. I have with me a guest. I don't think you've ever been on the podcast, Noah.
I don't think so.
We've recorded a couple of random test experimental podcasts that we never published. But for those of you who are curious, Noah Botkin is our software developer, runs the software developer team at T-Rex. But we're not going to talk about that, probably not going to talk about that in this episode. You just got back from Europe.
Yes. We went to England, Switzerland, and Prague, which was sort of an interesting speed run of different European countries with different histories.
And since you did a speed run of different countries over a real short amount of time and only looked at tiny swaths, you are in the perfect position to definitively and authoritatively say everything that is good and lame about those countries.
That's right.
That is the topic for today.
As an American, I am unusually qualified to make these statements.
Well, it should be noted that in addition to being an American, like pretty American Americans, I would say, we have also lived in New Zealand, and you have also traveled other places, so.
Yeah, this is actually my fifth time to Europe.
Yeah, but
it's crazy.
I would say a good American foundation, but also have seen a thing or two. So you know a thing or two.
Yeah.
So what were the first things you noticed that were different on this trip? Like, if you had to squeeze into a podcast episode, just hypothetically, observations from this trip.
Yeah, it's a little tough. I always find myself making bad comparisons because at this point in my life, I think I've spent more time in European cities than American cities. I'm never in a city unless I'm traveling.
Yeah.
So if I'm not careful, I make comparisons between American countryside and European cities. However, in general, public transport is a big thing there. Everyone knows this. Everyone talks about it. It's cheaper and takes up less space. Yes, the cities are walkable. Yes, the people there are not fat. I think the only obese people I saw in Europe were other American tourists.
Interesting.
Which was sad. People there are generally more fit. The food is generally better. This is also becoming a meme that I'm seeing more and more. People complaining, wow, American food's just terrible. And yeah, it is.
It is true. When we moved back from New Zealand, it was kind of shocking to me how much sugar was in everything.
Yeah.
I really should figure out a food guy, a nutritionist or somebody to talk about how American food is broken. Because it isn't just that Americans are greedy. That's the old meme.
Mm-hmm.
The new meme is that the FDA has betrayed us.
Yeah, with seed oils and GMO and all sorts of things, which I don't know. I've always sort of considered nutrition a pseudoscience because there are so many people that say different things and there are so many fads that sweep through the industry.
I think it's infinitely more complicated than our current understanding.
Yeah.
But we understand it better than we did, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So.
But I've always considered it sort of impossible to understand. And I think maybe that's just lazy on my part.
Well, and I would say we've talked about this on previous episodes. Not only has the FDA kind of messed up food, but massive federal farming subsidies that essentially dictate what the primary ingredients of American food are going to be.
Such as corn.
Corn, soybeans, etc.
Because we have a lot of corn bought up by land barons in the Midwest.
Almost every American food has a lot of corn in it, and all American beef is corn-fed because corn is paid for by the government and essentially free.
Yeah, and cows are not even very good at digesting corn, but it works well enough.
Yeah. So back to Europe. Yes. Let's talk about Switzerland for a little bit. Switzerland does cows. Switzerland does cows differently than America.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about Switzerland cow industry. We did have a day to the Alps, and they do put bells on all their cows, and it does sound amazing when you are looking around you at the Alps and then you hear like the constant white noise of the bells echoing through the valley. The cows
climbing the Alps.
Yes. As the next generation says, the vibes are immaculate. And they really are. One of the interesting things about Switzerland is that their economy is pretty far ahead of the surrounding countries, probably because they didn't fight a super damaging war And they didn't adopt super socialist programs directly after the war, like mm-hmm. England did. Yeah, England got really centrally managed. Most countries did while they were fighting the war, because that's typically what happens. And then it's
a very pragmatic move when you're fighting a war.
And it takes a long time to roll back those centralizations. So, like, Germany rebounded faster than Britain did after mm-hmm. World War II, which is just insane. And World War I, for that matter.
And World War II is interesting. I think that a massive... there's a couple of books that touch on this. The Dead Hand is one. And other books kind of about the dawn of the Cold War. Part of the reason that America and other allies, Europe and England in particular, were very slow to roll back some of those World War II centralizations is they went straight into Cold War centralizations.
Yeah.
And Switzerland didn't have that issue. And even Germany didn't really have that issue. They were right in the middle of the Cold War. It wasn't really a thing they were prepping for in the same way that England and America and other countries were. So that's part of the reason that those centralizations stuck around. Ironically, we kept giant socialized, centralized government structures in the purpose of fighting communism.
The PR contest that the Cold War was is interesting. But anyway, the interesting thing about Switzerland is, not to skip all that. So Switzerland's economy is very rich and advanced. Switzerland's GDP per capita is one of the highest in the world. I think maybe they're behind Luxembourg. But their median salary is about the same as America. It's a little bit lower. And I think that's adjusted for purchasing power. So as an American in Switzerland, Switzerland didn't feel terribly expensive. But Switzerland's economy is way richer than all of the countries surrounding it. So if you live in Switzerland and you want to go shopping or go on a vacation, you go to Poland or Italy. And everything is half the price, and you can live like a king. Like, even if you're a barista, I was talking to a barista at a coffee shop, and she's like, yep, I take a trip to Poland, that's where she was from, you know, once a quarter, that's where I get my hair done and all this other stuff, because it's so cheap. And, and that's one of the perks of living in a rich economy, you know, in the economy, all the wages are higher and everything is adjusted to be more expensive. So it's kind of a wash within that economy. But then once you go outside of it, you realize how powerful you are. And that's my experience as an American. As an American, I am rich by default because I operate in a rich economy.
You operate in a rich economy and you can travel to poor economies. Most Americans, so we don't really see this as much in America. The other meme is that Americans don't travel, don't see other stuff. But America is very big. Americans who travel often travel inside the United States. And the federal government makes sure that there is a lot of equality across the American economy. You don't notice counties and states that have abominable economic policies because the consequences are kind of spread out across multiple states. The EU does that a little bit, but not nearly as much.
These countries still maintain their own. I don't really understand which countries use the euro and why. England still has the pound. Switzerland still has their franc. And the Czech Republic still has the kroner.
Mm-hmm.
But they are all, to a certain extent, still within the EU. I mean, obviously, England is supposed to exit, but they still haven't.
Brussels kind of manages money and bailouts and things, even for the countries that maintain their own currency. But there still is enough economic and other types of freedom there for governments to do what they want. What about other types of freedom? Did you feel, as you were bopping around these different countries, the cold, dead hand of totalitarianism pressing down upon you?
Not terribly. I mean, sadly, we were in a lot of touristy areas, so they were artificially wealthy for that reason. Probably, so one of the interesting thing was just going from Zurich, which is one of the richest cities in the world. You know, Switzerland has a minimum wage of $26 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Prague, which is a fairly, big city. But for comparison, the minimum wage in the Czech Republic is $5 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of whiplash there. All of the industries and services that use a lot of labor are super expensive in Switzerland. and they're really cheap in Prague. So restaurant food is about half price in Prague or less. As far as totalitarian controls, Prague, the Czech Republic has an interesting history where, you know, they got steamrolled by the Nazis and, you know, the National Socialists, and then the regular socialists came and pushed the National Socialists out. What's interesting about that, though, is that, and I didn't really understand this, probably because I just don't know Eastern Bloc history very well, there was a communist party in the Czech Republic, well, I guess it was Czechoslovakia at the time, which emerged fairly organically. Like, obviously, they had very strong ties to Russia, mm-hmm. and it became a member of the Soviet Union, but Russia didn't do a hard invasion, so to speak, at first. They did later, after the Communist Party in the Czech Republic started weakening, you know, 20 or 30 years after it was formed, and the Russians thought they were syncretizing. Then they rolled in with the troops and set up a Russian-Soviet government. But that wasn't until, like, the 70s. Right.
There was this wave of Bolsheviks that swept across Europe trying to start international socialist revolutions. Yeah. They were obviously very successful in Russia. They were less successful in other places.
They were pretty successful in Czechoslovakia.
A lot of Eastern Europe, yeah. They planted those seeds, and people believed that was a really good form of government until they saw what Soviet Union was doing. Yeah, in the Czechs' case, it was a little too late because the Soviets were willing to drive in with tanks.
So, yeah, we got to spend some time with a local pastor in Czechoslovakia, super interesting guy. And I heard pretty much the same thing that I've heard from Russians about Russia. A lot of the social structure is still there, and a lot of the trust issues are still there. So, like, you don't talk to your neighbors. Mm-hmm. You don't have relationships with people unless, like, friendliness is not a thing that you do. If you live in a neighborhood and you have neighbors, you don't just take them cookies.
Right.
Or, you know, invite them to a barbecue. That is suspect. Which, he was saying, makes evangelism really hard to do because you don't have an excuse to talk to anyone for no reason.
Right.
So even though he's in, he's here, he's found that the main way he can do evangelism and ministry is online because you can't talk to people in person there. The trust has been damaged too much during the time of Bolshevism and spies and KGB type entities.
Yeah, that is a fascinating. So two fascinating thoughts. One, you can theoretically get rid of all your Soviet informers overnight. Not really, but theoretically, you can.
Nobody knows that they're gone.
Exactly. Theoretically, you can just get rid of them all and have a new political government, but you never know if you got rid of them all. And even if you did get rid of them all, the psychological scars are still there on your culture and on your society. But the second thing is, apparently, even though there is deep distrust of people in person, the assumption that the internet is for talking to people has kind of overcome some of those things, interaction. Is that a thing?
I don't know how the Czechs use the internet. I have no idea. Presumably the same. But this was a super strong contrast from Switzerland because the people we interacted with in Switzerland were very friendly and absurdly generous. You know, like we'd go to a museum or something and be like, oh, sorry, we're technically closed. And we'd be like, yes, well, but there is this one exhibit we wanted to see and this is our last day in Zurich. And they'd be like, oh, all right, we'll take you in. And we saw this sort of generosity over and over again. And maybe it was special. But in general, it just seemed like they were not rigid letter of the law rule followers, which is really interesting because in Switzerland, they conform to a lot of the stereotypes that I've heard about Germans. They're neat, they're detailed, good at engineering, high standards.
Sense of humor?
I feel like I wasn't able to get a good sense of that. This seems like they're less rigid than Germans, which is cool. Of course, I haven't been to Germany, so I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, it is interesting that there's a lot of flack fired at Swiss reformers.
Yeah.
The reformers that went to Switzerland in the 1500s and put into place these incredibly hateful, rigid, puritanical, Calvinistic systems. And the fruit of that reformation in Switzerland is not the straw man.
The reformation in Switzerland, yeah. That's another thing. So we were mostly in Europe to find some source material about the various Reformation revolutions. So in Zurich, we learned about Zwingli. In Prague, we learned about Jan Hus. And those are very interesting. I got a different flavor of the Reformation then. I had just sort of always thought about the Reformation as this revival, evangelistic. You know, people were coming to Jesus in droves and learned, getting a personal relationship with their Savior. And it was this huge enlightenment thing, or and that's not the right word, but...
A revival.
Revival, yeah. And that did happen, but a lot of the blood spilled around the Reformation was not about any of that. It was really about a shift in power. And a lot of the people who got on the side of the reformers were not interested in ideology insofar as they could use it to justify taking back power from the Holy Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah.
And that's...
Henry VIII, yeah, perfect example.
Perfect example. Yeah, we went to his castle. I can't remember what it's called. Hampton Court. That was interesting. Henry VIII was such a character.
Yes, yeah. He is a living meme, except that he's not alive anymore.
People complain about the inflation that happens today, but like in, I think, 3 short years, he debased the English currency from being 85% silver to 15% silver.
That's
very clever, yeah, with his mints. Yeah. Anyway, that's a different story. Yeah.
No, he's a perfect example, though, of a guy who, as soon as there was the glimmer of a Reformation and a challenge to the authority of Rome, he jumped on that bandwagon for entirely political means. Mm-hmm. Political expediency was his game, not a more biblical way of doing stuff.
No. And so, and that's kind of the story of the Hussite Rebellion and, you know, the city of Zurich, you know, latching onto Zwingli. You know, they found in those reformers, Zwingli and Hus, a person that could be used as a figurehead for a political change or a justification for a political change. And worked pretty well. But the Hussite Rebellion is super interesting.
Yeah. We need to get some experts who have studied that, because there are, obviously, there are new political ideas, there are new theological ideas or rediscovery of old theological ideas, but there are new military ideas and new military technologies and new communication technologies that all emerged at that time. And what was happening with the Hussites is like a preview of a whole bunch of other stuff that happened afterwards.
Yeah, it sounds like the Hussite Rebellion was the first conflict where weapons were actually, like firearms, were used seriously. And it was definitely the first time where a militia used firearms.
Yeah.
Because you've got, you have this adoption curve with firearms where like the benefit needs to be obviously better than what currently exists. When you have professional soldiers, they're plenty good at traditional...
All their
weapons.
Training is for last year's stuff.
Yeah. And so, you know, if a trained guy with a longbow is superior to a trained guy with, you know, the ancient
matchlock.
Well, they didn't even have those yet.
Oh, they were still doing the touch hole and the handheld.
Yeah. And it was like, it looks like an RPG. It's called a pistol, but it's this RPG looking thing that you mount on your shoulder and you hold with one hand. So it's technically one handed. And so, yeah, if you give that to a professional soldier, he's not getting an upgrade. But if you give that to a civilian, you know, some woman who is a baker or has children, yeah, she's super effective. And so Jan Žižek, I think was his name, is this utterly awesome general who never lost a battle during the Hussite Rebellion. And, yeah, he armed militias with crossbows and these early pistols. And he put them in wagons and armored them, and they were called war wagons. And then you have these, you know, these completely untrained people shooting out of them as they drive toward a heavy cavalry unit. And they broke heavy cavalry with regular, like, peasants.
Yeah, regular peasants inside of metal wagons. Yep.
And it's described as the first, I think, artillery maneuver in history is the stuff he did. Just incredibly innovative.
It was the first tank charge, but they didn't really call it a tank. So we'll call it an artillery maneuver.
Some people call that the first tank.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I'll take it.
Ideas have consequences. And this is why people form up behind ideologues like Hus, like Zwingli. Even people who are not really on board with the ideology, they are on board with the change and the figurehead and the opportunity to fill the power vacuums that they see coming.
Yeah, it reminds me of the letters that Erasmus and Luther exchanged in Latin about very esoteric topics. And you'd be like, well, that's not practical at all.
Not going to change anything.
Lots of people were watching those exchanges with bated breath, and they were getting translated into vernacular, and people were reading them, and it was creating a lot of changes. And I think I was noticing that a lot about the different reformations is it always started at a scholarly, esoteric level.
Yeah.
You know, some scholar, some monk would be like, this seems wrong. And he would start complaining about it. And like, that seems really small. But it always turned into...
Yeah, I think we can see that today where American academia decides to change how we do gender studies. What could be more impractical and esoteric is something that covers gender dysphoria, a rare... rarely seen particular disorder. And now...
Yes. And then somebody realizes, I can weaponize that.
This is weaponizable.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, Karl Marx, I don't know, I haven't read much about Karl Marx, but, you know, he was a fairly unknown guy writing about fairly esoteric things, and people realized, yes, this is a new religion.
I think that as time goes on, some of those guys get sharper. Like, I definitely think there are people in American academia who are not... accidental leaders of movements, but they study their history and they say, aha, these tiny levers actually move big things, and I will be the guy. I'm going to get this ball rolling.
Yeah. I was just reminding of, you know, Charles Darwin, you know?
Yeah.
Where Darwinism got turned into a religion, and
he had some political beefs that went beyond Mitch's and barnacles. But I don't think that he planned on social Darwinism or political Darwinism the way that we have it now. This presupposition that everything goes from simple to complex affects every aspect of how you think about the world. But yeah, no, he definitely had a bit of an agenda. He was pushing a barrow, as they say, with his barnacle experiments and his finch observations. But I don't think that he realized what a linchpin he would be for certain groups.
Yeah.
If you had told him that the Jews would be eradicated based on some of his presuppositions, I'd be really curious to hear what his thoughts were. There's probably no way to know what his thoughts were, given that he wrote a book called The Origin of the Species, and then the other part of the title has to do with the preservation of the favored races.
Yeah. Either here nor there. Let's see. Totalitarianism, yeah, so that's a thing.
But you didn't see, like, jackbooted thugs dragging people to prison on this particular joint.
No, nothing interesting like that. Again, lots of touristy locations. And it is interesting. Everyone wants tourism. So generally, the touristy parts are the safe parts.
Touristy parts are well-maintained.
Yeah.
Now, this can be a downside. I've seen this in other nations. Tourist money is some level of artificial. And tourist economies get detached from reality a little bit, and that can have a negative effect over the long term.
Yeah, I've always looked down my nose on tourist economies, and I know they're, you know, for a lot of cities and communities and countries, it's kind of all they have. They do feel artificial. The skills that you develop to build a tourist economy don't seem to generalize very well to other sorts of things.
Right. You can't necessarily scale them. They don't transfer. Yeah.
Man.
So now that you're back in the United States, what do you miss from Europe, and what are you glad to see again?
Oh, I'm glad for this space. Obviously, I'm coming back to the country, so again, false equivalencies. Oh, I do miss the better food. It's kind of boring that there's basically just two languages in the States. Of course, I miss seeing the old 800-year-old, 500-year-old buildings everywhere. It's easy to get disconnected from history here in the States because there isn't very much of it around you.
Right.
And in Europe, you, like, especially in England, I feel like, you know, you can get lost of some country road and just end up at this old 500-year-old chapel, and everyone takes it for granted, so maybe they don't actually reap the benefit of feeling connected to history, but... As an American, when I go there, history feels much more real and significant. And just the compounding results of people being diligent and building for the future is something that you see. And it's inspiring. And you don't really see that in the States. Like, sometimes in New England, you'll see something that's 300 years old. But that's really pushing it.
Yeah, and it is. So there's a couple of aspects there. One is the fact that the American colonies are very recent history compared to lots of stuff that went on in Europe. But there's another issue, too, which is America is very big, and Americans have always been very quick to travel. So whenever there's a new opportunity, a gold rush here, oil discovered there, you'll just build a brand new city there, and people will just pull up stakes and go live in that brand new city. There isn't the same connection to the land either. And I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly allows you to lose ties to the past and to think in a very short-term sense.
I think that's a pretty natural result of land being cheap. You know, in England, land is so scarce. And I think in most of Europe, you know, if you have land, you don't just freely sell it, hope that you can find some more elsewhere cheaper.
Oh, for
sure. That's not really an option. Whereas in the States, land has been so cheap for so long, it's, yeah, you can move. Is that the government might give you land?
Well, and even now, when land prices, house prices are higher than normal, I still am not thinking of hoarding. I'm thinking of selling this piece in order to cover that piece.
And that's just unthinkable, especially with certain taxes in Europe. You know, inheritance taxes are huge. That's something that I didn't research as much as I would have liked to, the way inheritance taxes work in different countries. But that is a super important way that governments can control the balance of wealth in a country is how inheritance works. And yeah, inheritance taxes in England are pretty hefty.
Maybe that's something, it's less obvious when you go to coffee shops and such. When you're a tourist in Europe, you don't own anything. You're just traveling. But when you live in America, you own stuff. This is kind of going away. More people rent than own. More people lease than buy in a lot of different sectors. But over there in Europe, there's a lot of people who haven't owned property for a few generations, which means they're kind of not going to. So even just the concept of private property, that potentially can get eroded as a mode of thinking.
Yeah, I think that's pretty standard in cities.
Yeah.
Just the population density is such that land becomes really scarce.
And again, not owning land is not intrinsically bad.
Right.
But losing the concept of private property, I think, is this you will own nothing and you will be happy mindset is anti-economic development.
Try to think through, like, what's special about owning land? It's different from having a car.
Sure.
Or having a lease. What's special about owning land?
Substantial and more immovable. It is more grounding.
It would be a lot more. It'd be a lot more special if you could actually build whatever you wanted, but you actually can't. So owning land is really—it's not as significant as it used to be. Especially the whole property tax thing.
Right.
If you don't pay your property tax, your land is no longer yours. Was it ever yours in the first place?
All of these things are being eroded, and the most damaging is, I think, that mental space. When you stop thinking about land as an ownable resource, you're well on your way to not having a good shelf in your brain for private property.
Yeah. And I think in the States we've been on that path for a while. I mean, it's really hard for me to imagine, like, what if I actually owned a piece of land fully and completely? I mean, all right, ownership is really only as strong as your ability to enforce it. So,
yes. That's why we're Second Amendment peoples. That and Hussite rebellion studies.
Yes. Ownership is a strange concept, honestly. here are some atoms. These are mine. it's kind of weird. But it is in the Bible, and it's something that is really significant for reasons that I feel like I am still coming to understand.
Yeah. Well, it's better than the alternative, which is saying, here are some atoms, and they belong collectively to a people group that is not definable, but these guys with armbands are in charge of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just finders keepers all the time. Yeah, it doesn't work as well. Well, there's one other interesting thing that I learned when I was in England. So we went to Cambridge, which is not a college. Cambridge is a university, and then within it exists
contains colleges.
Many colleges, yes. And it's sort of interesting the way that works, because the university owns a lot of the cool stuff. Like, the university has the nanotechnology lab. We didn't see all that cool stuff. We were mostly looking at old stuff, which is also cool in its own way. So we went to Jesus College, which is, I think, the oldest college, or at least they have one of the oldest buildings that was a chapel from the either the 800s or the 1200s, which 400 years is a long time, but when it's that long ago, it doesn't feel like a very long time.
Right, yeah.
I went to the Champion of the Thames. There are so many pubs there, and they're so great. You go and you get a pint. So I sat down, and I struck up a conversation with an old gentleman, and I learned that he was a professor of English, and he specialized in the years from 1200 to 1500. And that is a cool thing about Cambridge, is you go there and you bump into people who have devoted their lives to studying history and other things. It'd be nice to spend more time in Cambridge. And then later we went to another pub and we sat down with some folks that supported the university in other ways, various. Actually, we met the choir director, not the director, but some involved with the logistics for, I believe, the King's College Choir, which is kind of a big deal for some people I know. We were talking, and he was talking, you know, about how much he loved America. And, you know, he went there one time, and he discovered pancakes with maple syrup, and he was just in ecstasy about maple syrup and transports of joy. And, oh, yes, I would eat this every morning. And I said, oh, yeah, well, then you'd probably look like an American, too. And then he'd be like, ah, well, no, no, no. I know my place. America leads and the world follows.
Interesting. So he had a defeatist, might be the wrong word, but kind of a defeatist attitude towards the no longer jockeying for position.
No.
America is definitively top nation.
Yes, it does seem like that. And then the conversation went on. And then he leaned over to me in sort of hushed tones. He said, but you know, America and England have a special relationship. I was like, oh, really? I said, you tell, do tell. And you know, he said, yes, well, long ago, there was actually a war fought, and America used to be a part of England, and it isn't anymore. And I was like, oh, yeah, yes, that's true. In fact, that's kind of the core of our nation's identity, is this war that you're talking about. It's kind of the first thing that anyone learns about history in America, is that we declared independence and won our rights. At least, I don't know. I think they teach that in the school.
It used to be taught in the schools when we were kids. Yeah.
And he was flabbergasted that that was a thing that everyone knew, because when he was, I don't know what school he went to. I think it was probably a government public school.
Which they call private schools. But yes, a government school. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a special
this is why I advocate government school as the label, because private and public are too fuzzy. Besides, public schools in America, not actually public, not actually open to the public, not listening to the public, not governed by the public.
Fair.
They're government schools.
Yeah. Yeah, that says.
He would go on. He was surprised.
Yeah, he was amazed, because when he was, what he learned was that America was just another one of the colonies.
Back when the British Empire
had many, many colonies.
Yeah. There was a brief period of time, you know, 50 years or so, where the United Kingdom ruled over one quarter of the Earth's population.
Yep, the sun never set on the English, the British Empire, which is actually now true of America. We have so many military bases across the world.
It's true.
That I think are technically American soil. That is an empire. The sun never sets on the American Empire.
Right.
But yeah, he was amazed. They weren't taught that.
All the colonies more or less left England in different ways, and America
just left a little sooner.
Yeah.
For some reason. But it's not important.
Yeah. I see it as a pretty core American identity touchstone up until possibly recently. I think the current touchstone for government school education is there were all these slave owners.
Yeah.
And then somehow trans rights.
I feel like that's true. I feel like Martin Luther King is like better known than George Washington these days. Yeah.
We need to get our hands on some actual curriculum to look up these things. But it's, So, and I have talked about on this podcast a slightly alternative take, because I think that the take that is generally taught, which was the British were these stodgy old tea drinking nonsense people, and Americans wanted to do things their own way. So we just kicked them right out of the whole country, got rid of them redcoats. When you look at the colonies, you see 13 colonies that have their own laws, they have their own elected officials. They have their own compacts and constitutions and congresses. And they would like for England to continue interacting with them the way that the contracts and the compacts and the constitutions say. And England is getting too big for its britches and too big for its boots and becoming very imperial, and taxation is going through the roof, and Americans are getting called upon to go fight in foreign wars. And it is the Americans who actually say, we want to stay the course. England is going to have to go this way without us. So it isn't that America split off to go its own way. It was that England was straying into this new political territory. And America was the one that said, we're going to stick to our rights. We're going to stick to our founding documents. We're going to stick to our guns. And we're going to stick to the same direction that you are departing from. It's more nuanced. It's more complicated. But I think it's more historically accurate. And it is more helpful than the whole, we decided we didn't want to have no king no more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we did actually decide that we wanted George Washington to be the king. And he said, no, that's terrible. I know, guys.
Yeah, I don't know how many people thought that was a good idea, but that was the way it was done.
Yes.
Up until that point, you know, because monarchies were still the status quo. You know, the idea of a democracy was pretty fresh. Actually, where did they get the idea for a democracy and a republic? Because this is like a brand new idea. What were they reading?
Oh, so this is a fascinating topic for another episode of T-Rex.
So tune in next time.
Tune in next time. Well, this is a fascinating thing. I have, speaking of Cambridge, I have a fantastic book on this very subject of what they were reading. And I have not recommended it to people because it is so expensive to buy books.
I know a place.
But you know a place now. So we will revisit this topic. But the short answer is they were reading a lot of the reformers that you went over to Switzerland to find out about. They were reading about the Swiss cantons that had a very decentralized governmental structure. Whether or not they had monarchies or parliaments or whatever, they were looking at the Reformation, which tried to decentralize power and building on a lot of those ideas. And so that is where a lot of the political thoughts comes from. And of course, they were aware of writers on the other side. I've seen so many people say, like, well, of course they would have read Hobbes's Leviathan, and that's probably where they got some ideas. And it's like, well, have you read Hobbes's Leviathan? Because they did the exact opposite and tried to make sure that that would never happen. So probably not influenced by him in the way that you think.
Yeah, I definitely would agree about that. Jacques Barzun is this, I don't know how to describe him, historian that people used to think was a big deal, and maybe he is, but he wrote a magnum opus called From Dawn to Decadence. The theory of the book is, I think, the last 500 years has been punctuated by basically three revolutions, big paradigm shifts in the way people do power. You know, the first one is the Reformation, where you sort of get rid of your Holy Roman Empire, and then the second one is, you know, America and France, where they start to throw off the monarchies, and then the third one is where they start to experiment with these big totalitarian governments.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty even tempo between those events.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for his observations, and they're overly simplistic because the American Revolution, which put into place a republic that we call a democracy, and the French Revolution to put in place a democracy that they called republic, were almost opposite events.
Mm-hmm.
But at the surface level, they are the same.
Yeah.
Kings out, people in.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Paine will write the literature.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear what you've been learning about the underpinnings of thought.
Yeah.
It's the American Revolution.
It is a fascinating area of study. One of the most interesting things is just what an incredibly Puritan-driven nation America was.
Yeah.
And this is true both consciously by people who attended Puritan churches, but also subconsciously because people will have a vast cultural effect sometimes, like Charles Darwin, we talked about. He wrote a book about finches and preserving the most favored races, and it had massive ideological implications far beyond biology and political science. It seeped into the way that people thought about things and the shelves that they built in their brains. And the Puritans did that in America, even for the non-Puritan folks who lived here. And Thomas Paine is the perfect example of this.
This reminds me of something Paul Johnson observed in, was it his book, Intellectuals? I can't remember. But basically, when Einstein came out with the theory of relativity, lots of people were like, ah, yes, everything is relative. And they got like moral relativity from, from what Einstein is doing.
Yeah. It all depends on how fast you're going.
Your frame of reference. So the justifications people will make to justify a new ideology and specifically to do what is right in their own eyes is just stunning and incredibly reliable. People always do it.
Every time. It's a fascinating thing to study for sure. And somebody that I want to have on the podcast is a guy who grew up in Hong Kong, and he talks about how when you grow up, Hong Kong is, at the time, and today, really good at totalitarian gun control. Private gun ownership is utterly unthinkable to a lot of people. And once you don't have that shelf in your brain anymore, there's a bunch of stuff that you kind of stop thinking about. Sort of goes back to what we were talking about. If you can own land, or if land can be owned by individuals, that creates a framework for other types of thought about private property. If you cannot defend yourself at all, you kind of don't own yourself. You have no responsibility over your own self-existence or self-preservation. You kind of don't own yourself at all. And the shelves in your brain get sort of built around this other idea that you belong to the government. And your stuff belongs to the government, too. It's a very interesting sort of thing. These cultural shifts have massive implications for how you think about other stuff.
That is always true.
Exactly. Like,
there's always a bigger fish. There's always someone who's more powerful than you. And this is why wars are a thing. You know, like, private property isn't real. Like, people just steamrolls it every 200 years and conquers it and plants a flag in it. Like, no one owes stuff for longer than a few hundred years. Yeah, it is. It's kind of might makes right all the way down. We went spent some time in the British Museum, and every time I go to the British Museum, it's a great place to go. I highly recommend it. It's a study in power. There are exhibits dedicated to the early, you know, the Levant area and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians. And
yeah,
it's so interesting to see how these early people experiment with these early power structures. You know, the city-states are kind of the first thing that emerge. People centralize, they create cities. Cities create governments. The governments create armies.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these little dotted city-states dotted across the Mediterranean. And then eventually, one of those city-states turns into an empire. And that empire, like an amoeba, rolls across the landscape, absorbing other city-states.
Yes.
And pretty quickly, like, the city-state model is not sustainable. They're not strong enough to defend themselves, and the empires always take over.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that I noticed is that the Egyptians invented the empires about 1,000 years before anyone else figured it out.
They invented a very powerful empire on multiple levels, economic, military, cultural, etc. But they didn't want to steamroll people because they didn't want to get too far from home. And they didn't value other themselves. People very much. They didn't like other people very much.
So yeah.
You're not even human if you're not Egyptian. So why would you conquer those non-human people over there? Just make them pay you tribute.
Actually, pretty good thing they were so racist.
Well, so this is a very interesting example right here that you bring up. It's very important that you do some more serious study on stuff. Because if you say something like, the British Museum is a study in power, the surface level reading of that is just, yes, the British Empire used to be powerful and they stole all of everybody's useful historical artifacts for themselves.
Well, sure.
And that is kind of what happened. But if you look deeper and you actually look at the historical artifacts themselves, yeah, you see the records left behind by empires, by emperors, by kings, going back to those first experimental ones. So, yeah. There's always a deeper level to study too.
It's I highly recommend it to anyone listening to the podcast. Go to the British Museum and walk the halls, and just see how long people have been fighting over scraps of money and strips of land and women. It's fundamental human nature.
Yeah. And the other thing that I love about the British Museum, it is changing a little bit, but modern museums are so lame. It's hard to find a museum that just has actual historical artifacts that you can look at as opposed to random infographics.
And it's pretty good.
The British Museum is very good at having the actual stuff. you know, thanks to British.
And the bias is honestly light.
The bias is light, and there's not a lot of spoon feeding. There's a whole bunch of amazing stuff in the British Museum that you have to find its implications for yourself. There isn't a giant, colorful, fourth grade infographic on the side. And that is what a lot of modern museums are turning into. Basically, daycare center level stuff.
Yeah.
It's highly annoying to me.
Now, the British Museum is a gem, even though, yes, they stole a lot of stuff.
Well, they stole a lot of stuff, but they
want it fair and square.
They want it fair and square, and they got it from other people. So there's currently a bunch of Egyptian people asking for the Rosetta Stone back.
Yeah.
Because the Rosetta Stone was found in Egypt. But the Rosetta Stone is not an Egyptian artifact. And first the French took it, then the English took it from the French. But it is actually one of these stones from a conqueror of Egypt saying, this is a marker to let you guys know that you have been conquered. So it isn't even an Egyptian artifact to begin with. And there's a whole bunch more. So you could... It's a complicated business.
Yeah.
Anyhow. So a couple of weeks ago, several weeks ago now, I asked podcast listeners what they wanted. They said they wanted more. So this episode is longer. They also said they wanted more variety, more broadness from the podcast. So hopefully this fit the bill.
Oh, cool. Do you not talk about history all the time?
I talk about random stuff all the time, and apparently people want more of that. So there we go.
Yes, they basically want you to be the Second Amendment James May.
Well, that is pretty high praise coming from you. If that is actually what people want, I can't quite live up to it, but I can certainly be that random.
Yes.
So thank you very much for having this conversation, Noah. I want to have more conversation with you, as we've talked about in the past. You have interesting insights into technology since you run the dev team, software dev team, and you have a lot of other interesting observations as well. But I wanted to get you on here and talk about European observations, because the next guest that I want to have on is a good friend of ours who lives in England,
yes,
who recently visited the United States. And it'll be interesting to compare his initial observations with yours, even though you sounded very stuff. He did not come over here to study our rich history of repentance, revival, and resistance. He just came over to see friends. But he's a pretty observant guy, so I'm curious.
Oh, no. And he's done so much more traveling than I have. No, I thought multiple times, like, man, you gotta get Chris on here.
Yes.
He has much more interesting things to say about the Swiss and the Germans.
Very, very good. Well, we will chase him down. Get him on the podcast. I meant to record a podcast while I was here, but then I realized, it's the internet. We can always Zoom call later.
Yeah, get him a good mic for sure.
Every time that we had a conversation here, it was about something that I didn't want to be public. And he didn't want to be public either. So that's why that didn't happen yet. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening to this random ramble through observations about Europe from Noah. I appreciate the other thing that you guys did while you were over there. And this was super fun. If ever you guys are traveling, listening to the podcast, or friends of yours are traveling, we had a super fun Signal group chat going between people who are on the trip and people who are home. And it was a very low pressure thing for you, I think, on the trip.
Yeah.
Just instead of sending pictures to random people, on Facebook or specific people over and over and over again one at a time. That felt like a great way to experience the
trip. It
was
great. It was like live microblogging.
Yeah.
Is what Twitter was made for.
Yeah. So get yourselves, if you're listening to this podcast, get yourselves your local community friend group of not too many people. And if one of them goes someplace cool, have a chat around that. Don't just do it on Instagram for 40,000 folks or whatever. Don't just do it to one person at a time. Build these little community groups, even around things like one of your friends going to Europe, because that was super fun.
Yeah, it worked really well. I agree.